Once it gets to court, it's black and white. Either you're right or you're wrong. And a subject matter expert on the other side of the table, if you're not doing daily work reports, if you don't have photographs of your isolations and your ventilation strategy, you're easy pickings.
This is the one and only, the original podcast where you can find yours and your business's true value. You're listening to Our Value,
brought to you by America's insulation source, IDI Distributors.
You want to hear from the best contractors, suppliers, and consultants that dedicate themselves to more than just survival in the business world?
Industry professionals that are dedicated to excellence in every aspect of their business?
Our Value has them all here to share that same motivation and knowledge with you. Tune in and grow a more successful, profitable, educated, and recognized business. Listen to the Our Value podcast to become the industry leader in your market. Find your value with Our Value.
Welcome to this Our Value podcast. Let me tell you, this is one you want to share with both your operations and your sales teams. Today, we are talking about how to protect yourself and not lose to an expert witness. Now, obviously, I'm sure we all know the best way not to lose to an expert witness is to make sure you install good foam, never have a bad job, and don't find a psychotic customer. Well, that's a pretty high bar, and most people realize it's an unrealistic expectation. There's always going to be a crazy, loon for a customer, and there's always going to be a weird code official, and, there's also going to be a day the customer, the crew, the chemical, or even what was in the contract got it wrong and something went sideways. That is why today I wanted to introduce all of you to Tom Harris. Tom's been involved at every level of the spray foam industry, from chemistry to spraying military structures in foreign countries. It has made him a subject matter witness or a subject matter expert for attorneys, contractors, and building owners in too many situations to count. Tom, welcome to the show. We are so glad you could do this.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Ken, and I appreciate the opportunity. It's a real honor and a pleasure to meet with your audience and you yourself. You know, we've known each other for quite a while. I appreciate the opportunity. So thank you.
When did you get into foam and why? What was the attraction to spray foam?
Well, when I graduated in 1981, such a long time ago, I realized, but back in 81, I attended university, chemical engineering, technology, and that sort of thing, downtown Toronto. So it was quite an experience. But the chemistry of polyurethanes wasn't a in-depth subject matter at that time. As a matter of fact, polyurethane foam was mentioned for maybe a page in most of the books. But I did my thesis on the use of polyurethane foam in the automotive industry. When I graduated, I got that stack of here, these people want to talk to you opportunities. And the first one, I think, was an adhesive group. I moved on to the second one in the stack, and it was CIL. They're a paint company, and they make ammunition. And I thought, well, let's give that a try. It says polyurethane here. I know a little bit about polyurethane. So I went over, and I was introduced to a guy by the name of Tony Abasella that was their chemist. And he was telling me all about this magic of urethane foam and what it was all about. And he said, watch this. And he mixed two chemicals together in a little cup and mixed them together. And it went from a liquid to a solid in 3 seconds. That's cool. I ran all of the chemistry that we were developing together through this thing and established QC. And I worked some of my vacation time in production. I loved it. Sitting around the CIL and listening to sales meetings, I was starting to get interested in marketing. At the next trade show, BASF actually approached me and said, hey, this would be an opportunity for you, maybe. Immediately got hired by BASF and introduced BASF to spray foam in Canada. And in 93, they said, okay, well, you're done in Canada. That worked great. Can you do it again in the U.S.? So they transferred me down to Detroit and Wyandotte, Michigan, and with the BASF Corp in the U.S. And I got them into the spray foam industry in the U.S. and worked there for 23 years. I then moved over to Honeywell. I worked on HFO for 10 years with Honeywell, and then I went to LAC, which was later Huntsman. and had various positions. So it's been quite a career, but it all started with a little shop up in Toronto.
So Tom, obviously you've been in, you know, some might say since the beginning. And, you know, today I know that you have helped so many contractors. And because you are an expert witness on all facets of this, over the years while doing this, have you ever seen a situation where foam was called into question and the fact that the contractor actually had daily job site reports, has that ever been what got them out of hot water?
Absolutely. I do a reasonable amount of litigation work and as a subject matter expert. And sometimes I'm for the homeowner, sometimes I'm for the contractor, sometimes I'm for the manufacturer, you know, it varies. But there's an important point here to be made that there's a big opportunity for contractors to keep it out of court. Keep it away from the lawyers. If it gets to the lawyers and litigation and all that, it's gone too far. It's either black or white now. You're either right or wrong. And that can be mitigated up front when the contractor gets a complaint. So my biggest recommendation these days is to handle those complaints before they get to litigation. Once it's in litigation, now we start to show me the facts. It's only about the facts. It's what you produce in your documentation that saves you. So if you don't have daily work reports, if you don't have, I mean, now we've got accurate dynamic ACE reports and all this sort of thing. If you don't have that information to provide to your lawyer, they're going to find out that you don't. And that immediately impacts your credibility. If you're Go ahead. If you're not documenting everything that you do, and a lot of companies like IDI has that daily work report. Up in Canada, they have to file those every single day, every single job. They have to do testing every time the batch changes. Well, down here, we don't do that. If we did, it makes it difficult to point a finger at the contractor. You retain your credibility through all the documents that you provide.
So do you see where attorneys are now familiar with the fact that you should have these? Like, is there, when, you know, a lot of these attorneys will go to LexisNexis or places like that, is there kind of an established thing where even a junior attorney might figure out that you should have these in the first place?
Yeah, it depends for the subject matter expert who employs them. If they're employed by the, let's say, the manufacturer or the homeowner or the building owner, and there's been a problem with foam, their subject matter expert, remembering that it's a subject matter expert, understands the industry. They know what the industry standards are. They know what the expectations are, and they ask for those documents. And if you can't provide them, well, then we've got something to talk about.
You've got to win.
It's not quite cut and dry, but yeah, you build the case.
That makes sense. I didn't even think about the fact that, you know, even the most junior attorney is going to go find a subject matter expert. Now, right. What about, even because, you know, you've been around the chemistry long enough and everybody gets harped on about, you know, what temperature were the drums and all of that. When I say, what about drum conditioning? Have you ever seen where proper storage and handling actually could have kept someone out of a lawsuit?
Yes, absolutely. It's a good point, Ken. I mean, the manufacturers have labels on the drums that usually have the storage requirements, temperature requirements. And most tier one manufacturers will ship to the destination. Could be a warehouse, could be a distributor like IDI. They'll ship under somewhat controlled conditions. So we know that the manufacturer shipped to the, let's use IDI, to the distributor within those parameters. We know that IDI stores within those parameters. IDI loads the material onto a truck, a contractor pulls in, you fill him up. Now, how do we know that the contractor abided by those storage conditions? That's a difficult thing to prove or disprove. And you look at weather reports. You look at where was it stored? Is that a heated warehouse? Is it temperature controlled? In the Northeast, in the North, you've got a very low temperature outside in the middle of winter, but you're still working. You're going to take it from your controlled atmosphere warehouse at 70 degrees. You're going to put it on the back of the truck, 9 times out of 10, flat loaded, not on a pallet, but flat loaded on the bottom, on the floor of the van. And it goes down the highway for an hour. The indoor temperature of that van may be 60, 55. Yeah, you're touching it. It's not so bad. But the floor is cold. And that chemical that's on the bottom of that drum gets cold. It now gets below the storage recommended temperature. Isocyanate, it's critical. I mean, the viscosity of the resin will go up for sure and make it difficult to transfer to the back of the machine once you get on site. But that ISO has the potential to what they call seed. And that's a problem. Now, when we get to the job site, we get in the back of the van and it's, oh, not bad, 60, 65 degrees. But you've been driving for an hour and it's 10 outside. And the bottom of that ISO drum, when we put our transfer pump in, that's the material we're pulling into our transfer pump, is the coldest part of that drum. So when we pull it up, push it to the back through the screens, now those seeds, because our ISO seeds at 50 degrees, now start to clog that inbound filter. Now you're going to cavitate the ISO side. Now you're going to be resin rich at the gun. And now you've got a problem.
But I guess what I'm asking though is, have you seen in a case where the fact that there wasn't conditioning, that there wasn't proof, and that could be proven, that cost them the deal?
Yes.
So as a contractor, then I would want to make sure I have, at the very least, somewhere built on my premises, or proof that I've got the blankets, or, you know, I guess there's a lot of ores you could put in there, but I was trying to figure out, you know, like real cases that you've seen. I know I've seen the next one in action, but have you seen where proper ventilation would have prevented a lawsuit? Like a case where that happened?
Absolutely. The number one complaint that I handle, like phone rings, I pick it up, it's a homeowner. The number one complaint is odor. And what we don't understand is, when we talk about this concept of isolation and ventilation, it's extremely important to deal with odors, not just containing airborne MDI and all that sort of thing. That's what our PPE is for. But when it says reoccupy 24 hours and you got to run that ventilation, that's what you're pulling out, is that potential for odor. We know that foam typically is inert within 24 hours. No more, it's done off gassing, it's finished, it's solid. So anything that comes off in that 24-hour period, we want to evacuate, just get it out of the house. And we isolate the work area, because if we are working in the attic and there's an open stairwell, maybe an open staircase going to the main floor, if we're happily spraying away in the attic, we're putting particles in the air. And I like to think about it as smokers. When you go into a house where someone is a smoker and they smoke in the house, you smell it. They're not standing beside you smoking a cigarette, but you can still smell it. And as a matter of fact, if it lingers long enough and it's present long enough, it gets on the walls, it gets on the carpet, it gets on the dog, gets on the couch, gets on everything. So you may install your foam and they've got a bit of an odor complaint. Yeah, okay, well, it'll go away in a few weeks, you know, this sort of thing. It won't, because it's come down, those particles have come down the stairwell and settled on those permeable materials, you know, those textures, those textiles, even on the walls.
When you talk to that homeowner, though, I guess what I want them to understand, we've told them incessantly that they need to ventilate. But when you talk to that homeowner, what's the process you go through? I mean, I've been asked, well, who do we have come out? Should we, check the air? And I said, well, you're going to need to find yourself an expert witness. Obviously we're on the side of the contractor. What's the process? What usually happens?
Well, there's usually a complaint. So the homeowner smells something, they don't like it. There's a complaint. Now you have to remember that we're an industry. We're manufacturing foam on site, and there's parameters that we set. We make good foam, and that's great. But we're putting stuff in the air, and we have to remember that it's that airborne stuff that they can smell. We are subject to OSHA, EPA, all those requirements. And we protect ourselves with PPE during the installation. And then we ventilate for 24 hours to protect the homeowner. So if we're not doing that, we're not ventilating properly and isolating our work area to protect the homeowner, dirt and shit, they're going to have a problem. Here's the crux of it is that our foams run through an industrial VOC evaluation. We measure what comes off and when it goes to essentially zero. And that's great. That's not a nose test. That's not an odor test. That's a chemical test. That's volatile organic compounds. I don't care what they smell like, they're VOCs. And we monitor that, and you get the green guard gold seal of approval. That's great. That doesn't mean you can't smell it. So there's a big difference between being compliant from a VOC standpoint and being odor-free. So there's a big difference. People are more sensitive to odors. They don't really care about the exposure limit. So the phone rings, it's somebody with an odor complaint. Why am I getting the call and not the contractor? 9 times out of 10, I will tell them, have you called the contractor? Oh yeah, they're stonewalling me. They haven't returned an email. There's situations. That's a management thing. That's on the contractor to follow, to respond to that issue. Because eventually the homeowner is going to get to the point where if you're not satisfying things, they're going to litigate. They're going to call a lawyer, claims will be filed, and it'll be a nightmare because you're not dealing with it up front. Now, when you deal with it, you need to evaluate and determine, is all of this foam good? And equipment plays a big role in that, storage of materials, that's what we talked about. But you need to evaluate and make sure that you can confirm that that's good foam. You send a piece to the manufacturer, you do what you need to do. But you determine as a contractor that you installed good foam. Now, did you use isolation ventilation? Well, you check back to your old daily work reports, and yes, we did. Take lots of pictures. Pictures during the application are your best friend. They really are. They show the isolation strategy. They show the application itself. All these types of things. Photographs, photographs, photographs. They're your best friend. We don't seem to understand that an odor is like our old cigarette smell. It gets everywhere in the house. So you, as a foam contractor, go in and you look at the foam. Yep, it's good foam. Manufacturer says it's good foam. That's great. But I've still got this smell in my house. Yes, because it's on everything. So as a contractor, you may say, ah, dang, I didn't isolate and ventilate very well. Maybe some of it got downstairs. Maybe I didn't isolate the HVAC, didn't shut off the furnace, and it sucked it and pushed it through the whole house. Now, shit, I got a problem. What I recommend is that we bring in like Service Pro kind of thing, and clean every surface. Clean the floors, clean the walls, clean the carpets, clean the couch, clean everything. Clean it. That should remove any residual odor-producing stuff that you've got in the air. Now you've got a clean house, a clean environment. The foam is aged somewhat. It's usually behind some form of thermal or ignition barrier. It shouldn't continue to odor, to off gas. A big advancement in the formulation side, to speak to the manufacturers for a moment, is these non-emissive catalysts. That's key. That's great. Good stuff. Now our catalysts are actually bound in the polymer matrix. Years ago, they did their job and then left. So now we've improved the technology on equipment. We've improved the technology on the installer through education and isolation and ventilation. So that application method is now better. And we've improved the chemistry for low odor, low VOC. So we're working in the right direction. And I hope one day I never get a phone call on odor complaints.
Well, I agree. I've personally seen many, many where ventilation would have stopped the suit. But yeah, these people went in, foamed, and then closed it up and let it marinate. And yeah, that is such a problem. And I agree. Photos, you know, the projects I'm typically involved in, obviously we're taking quite a few photos, but I love that you said they're your best friend, and you brought up equipment, because something I've seen more recently, I didn't used to see it as much, but have you seen what some would call the hobby type equipment create problems, or, you know, obviously lack of maintenance on standardized equipment that we all use, but have you seen where the hobby equipment created problems that people couldn't get beyond?
Yeah, and you've seen YouTube videos, you know, DIY installers, the kits and cans, you know, this sort of thing. But when we move up into the industrial, the professional side, there's all different types of equipment as well. Some of it's a little less technically advanced than others. And when you get into the higher end, Ken, you know, there you've got ratio monitoring and ratio adjusting. You've got better control of temperatures. And remember, in the gun, when we force those two chemicals together, we want the best mix possible. And that comes from the same viscosity of materials coming together. If it's higher viscosity, you get a higher pressure on that side, and it actually moves in the mixing chamber. It'll move that mix point. And once you do that, that pattern, that swirl that comes out changes. Your mix energy changes. Not necessarily your ratio, but certainly your quality of foam is impacted by your lack of control. So that's really, really important. That's a great advancement in equipment these days. Cavitation used to be a big problem. And that goes back to your storage, your material storage. Cavitating that pump will create an air pocket that moves down your hose. You won't see it because you've compressed it to 1200 PSI. It's actually in the liquid now. But when it gets to the gun and feels the atmosphere, you know, I'm free at the end of the gun, you'll get that air blast, that pocket comes through, and now you're 100% the other side for that instantaneous moment. I've seen on projects a chunk of foam that has about the size of your thumb, spots in it that are pure chemical. And those can last years.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of, you know, as the economy changes, you've got what I would call your traditional equipment. Sorry. And then we have some of these that we'll just call it the $7,000 full setup. With, you know, I'm sure they'd like you to put it in 5 gallon buckets and put the two dipsticks in and start spraying. And you usually are picking it up off of, you know, Alibaba, or, you know, there are some people in the US selling them. But have you seen where those created specific problems or couldn't make good foam for a job?
Yes. And it depends on how you define good foam. And that becomes problematic, because if we have a new contractor who's got into the game a little on the low side, they've got inadequate equipment potentially, but you probably have a hard time finding who the manufacturer of the foam was. So you've got two things working against you. You've brought in uncertified or difficult chemical to work with, and your machine is not quite up to industry standards. And quite frankly, Ken, that's easy pickings for subject matter experts.
That makes total sense. So, I guess out of everything you think of, what are maybe the top five things you would advise people to focus on so they don't lose in court?
It's a good question, Ken. And odor control is the big one. And the quality of your installed foam, take samples, do the testing, adhesion, cohesion. If you have questions, stop and figure it out. Don't bury it. But I truly believe that this concept of isolation and ventilation being the number one complaint is going to be, if you address that, then you're well on your way to keeping your litigation potential down. Not saying you won't have claims, because there's always, as you mentioned earlier, that homeowner that's a little hypersensitive. But you can deal with that. Once it gets to court, it's black and white. Either you're right or you're wrong. And a subject matter expert on the other side of the table, if you're not doing daily work reports, if you don't have photographs of your isolations and your ventilation strategy, you're easy pickings. So I would say isolation and ventilation. We've gotten through, I think, the shrinkage thing early on in HFO, and unfortunately with COVID and the supply chain, we had some offshore materials, some difficulty in getting raw materials and getting resins, and contractors got creative. These non-specific and non-specified and non-approved materials made their way into our market. And they haven't been through the rigorous testing that our manufacturers in the US have to go through. And they weren't of the same quality. So, a cautionary note here, what have we learned from that COVID supply chain issue is be careful who you buy from and what you buy and what you bring in. We are now in 2026, facing some supply chain constraints, which will hopefully not motivate contractors to get really creative. So be careful.
I think when I thought about this, I guess, I was like, okay, what are my five? And I listed five, and then I was like, oh my gosh, what about this? What about this? What about this? So I would say, I love that you said photos. I agree. Photos are your best friend. I think also, the contract, because so many foamers I'd trained over the years, were back of the napkin guys and didn't have a good scope of work. And I remember the attorney Carolyn Cromines for the industry said, well, if you don't have a good scope of work, an attorney will write one, a court will write one for you. And
It's true.
yeah, and then maintenance logs, obviously training, safety, walking away from psychotic people, the building science, but changeovers and transitional foam. You're right. When we had the original class action lawsuits that came up out of Florida and Boston, this was, 2012, half of the cases we were told about were failure to ventilate. The other half were transitional foam. And the idea of leaving this unknown chemistry in a house just it doesn't fly. And then obviously you get application techniques and metal roofs. I've seen, the wobbly substrates, but that's not, I mean, that's pretty cut and dry. But you mentioned the testing, yeah, density checks and even, the whole thermal barrier thing. I've seen people have to go back and do that, but I'm going to fall down, kind of where you are. I think my big ones, yes, the photos, absolutely the ventilation. I would also say the building science because a lot of contractors get called in needlessly because it has nothing to do with them. They go and they do a job, but they don't fight for the mechanical. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Exactly right.
Yeah, it's, these guys, they go out and they do a job and they've got somebody setting them up for failure, not because of the foam, but they're like, well, the house is too tight. Well, first off, there's no such thing. But the idea that you're going to leave this monster mechanical in there that won't deal with moisture And then you're going to turn around and blame me. I'm not the one that chose to build on wet concrete with wet wood, with wet paint, with wet mud and all of this other stuff. So, but, you know, you talked about when you normally get a call. How do you talk to a homeowner about phantom smells? Like, you go out, because you've got way more experience at this than I do. Let's say you go out, you show up, you smell nothing. And you know what foam smells like. You've grown up with it. How do you address phantom smells? Because I was told by building scientists in the industry, once they smell something, you're never going to get it out of their head. How do you approach that?
Well, it's a unique odor. And one thing that you have to determine up front, is this new construction or is this a retrofit?
Let's say it's a retrofit. Yeah, okay.
Right, which the majority of our applications are retrofit unvented attic assemblies. What we as contractors have to do, we manufacture the foam on site. So we have to make sure it's good foam. All of the different parameters come into play. It's good foam. Now, we as contractors need to understand, and it should be in our contract language, that we have changed the building envelope from an air tightness standpoint. We may have affected it a lot, we may have affected it a little, but we've changed it. So, I mean, there's all kinds of business opportunities that come to mind here, a ResNet Raider and all this kind of thing, and do blower doors and be qualified to do that. Not a bad idea, because if we've tightened the building envelope to some degree, that HVAC system is now working in an environment that it wasn't designed for. It certainly needs to be rebalanced and looked at and maybe resized, you know, these sorts of things. But contractors, good grief, but contractors don't understand the value of relationships with the people we interface with. Code inspectors. You should have a good relationship with a local code inspector. HVAC contractor in that area, you should have a good relationship with a reliable HVAC contractor that understands, so that when your contract document says, I'm going to install an unvented attic assembly at whatever R value, I may or may not be able to do the blower door test, but I will, you know, it needs to get done. And then the HVAC contractor needs to come back in and readjust your system, rebalance your system. Maybe we put in an ERV if one does, or an HRV if that doesn't exist. Maybe we put in a whole house dehumidifier if the relative humidity is up. Do we measure relative humidity as contractors? Probably not. But we should understand the impact that an unvented attic assembly has on, potentially, on relative humidity changes. So recommending, certainly, the HVAC contractor to come in and do a blower door test, or you do the blower door test to get that ACH50 number and go with the HVAC contractor and say, here's what I've changed. Here's the R value now. Here's the air change rate. I suggest you go back in and talk to Mrs. Smith about rebalancing the system and controlling the indoor air quality. So, you know, installing foam is really the easy bit. I don't want to say it's easy because I know it's not, but you're going to, the house is a system approach, you're going to change things and you need to understand the impact of those changes and then mitigate, correct, anything that you impact. And that will reduce your liability and your potential for risk and litigation associated with the work that you've done.
Something you said that I think might help me mitigate or handle phantom smells more than anything, because you went back to, you're always training foam contractors. I try and get a straight answer out of you about a customer and you train the foam contractor instead. But there's something you said, and I've never heard it. And I never thought about it until you said you're changing the environment. And while you went to training the contractor and blower doors, because I'm certified, I go do those things. But it never dawned on me that, you know, yesterday there was probably, we'll just throw out a wild number, let's say 15 air changes an hour. And today there's, we'll say, four. The phantom smell could be the fact that now everything else is enhanced. The litter box, the kitchen, the candles, the bathrooms. Do they have a humidifier? The dryer vent, socks in their son's room who doesn't do laundry but once a month.
The garage.
I'm going to add that to my list too. I am literally going to make a slide about this now because the fact of the matter is the phantom smell could be real, could be nothing to do with my foam, but did the foam not produce the smell, but let's just say enhance it? Well, absolutely. We stopped the 15 air changes.
Yeah.
And now
the HVAC is not running. It's not, you know, taking humidity out of the air. And the higher the humidity, the more sensitive we are to odor because it's the odor is carried on the water droplets that's in the air.
And the mold will grow, the mildew will grow.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all kinds of problems that we're creating, and all we're doing is insulating.
Yeah. So I guess this last one, it's going to be different in that, well, I've got more than one last one. Are you ever really able to help them win? Do you find that often there's just something the contractor's missing that will help them win?
And being from the manufacturing side, I understand that side of the equation as well. And years ago, you know, many years ago, 90% of the problems and 90% of the conversation, it's the contractor's fault. They manufactured the foam. We only make the resin and the ISO. Well, as equipment has gotten better, as training has gotten better, as applicators have gotten better, that 95% of the problem coming from the contractor is coming down. Now we're 80, 75, 70, 60%, 50% because contractors are getting better. As you get better, you shed some of that liability. The more documents you can do, the daily work reports, the testing, the understanding of what it is, if the material has a burp, you take it out. You don't leave it and bury it. We now understand that. That alone lowers that bar. It's no longer 95% of the contractors the problem. We're working on that and it's coming down. So the manufacturers are becoming a little more sensitive to that and their game is coming up. And that's a good thing. Now, how we handle our customers and their issues and their problems, again, is training and education and awareness. I think when we sell to a homeowner, especially a homeowner, we need to talk about the building science, the tight envelope, the impact of tightening up the building envelope, because it's not just R20. It's not just our value. We happily promote the fact that it's an air barrier, it's a vapor control layer, it's this, it's that. Well, there's impacts that we need to understand as contractors, and we need to convey to the homeowner so that they know what to expect. You know, the relative humidity may go up, the air changes will come down, so there will be lingering odors. So I see you've got five fish tanks in your living room. High relative humidity in the air carries more odors and puts relative humidity, the potential for mold, this, that, and the other thing. So we need to increase your insulation. You know, we need to make sure we control the potential for condensation with this high relative humidity that you've got in your house. That's different than the next call you might make. So you've got to be, as a contractor, as a salesperson, you've really got to be on your toes about looking at what the conditions are in this house and then thinking about the design, our value, vapor control, odor control, isolation and ventilation, and then HVAC mechanicals that are associated with that now tight building envelope. That's the complete package.
I agree wholeheartedly. It's funny you said fish tanks because, I mean, I was living in Montana and had about a total of 150 gallons and, you know, I'd make the windows sweat. I can't imagine what would happen if I'd have foamed the house. So let's say I get a call. Went out, I did a good job, I did all these things, and it's not even the homeowner. What is your best advice when I get a call and it's already an attorney. What's my next steps?
As a contractor, find yourself a subject matter expert. Actually, find yourself, and here's an interesting and important point. The contractor needs to have a lawyer that understands construction and litigation and all that sort of thing, because the subject matter expert will come up under the lawyer, not the contractor. So we are subject matter experts to the lawyer, because the lawyer is the one that handles the conversations. You, as a contractor, have already tried to fix the problem. You've either turned your back completely on it, or you're actually trying to fix the problem. Keep it out of the courts. Too late, it's gone to court. Well, you, as a contractor, are now out of it. You are just one of the parties that got sued. You need a lawyer. The lawyer needs the subject matter expert. I can't, if I get a call from a contractor, I can tell you what I think, but I know in the back of my mind, as a subject matter expert in this case, this is going to go to court. Contractor, you need a lawyer. I come up under the lawyer, because we need to know through documentation, through conversation, through discovery, they call it, we're going to narrow down where the liability actually resides. And I don't want to deal with the contractor. I want to deal with the lawyer, because the lawyer knows what questions to ask and what answers to give.
It's an important distinction. Am I correct in saying that there are subject matter experts that are more prone to the homeowner and subject matter experts that are more beneficial to the contractor?
Well, you know,
or is it generic?
I hope not. You know, the area that concerns me most is when a homeowner has got, well, I've got an indoor air quality test, you know, looked at VOCs. That industry is now looking at foam and calling foam bad. And they starting to build an inventory of what to look for and all this kind of thing. And, you know, there are certain problems associated with air quality testing. You put an air quality monitor in the middle of a room that's got an unvented attic assembly and their foam has been there for a year, and you run the test. You're picking up everything. Everything in that house, dog hair, dog dander, I mean, perfume, you know, you're picking everything up in that thing. And then you read the report, and everything that they've identified as an airborne contaminant, none of it's from foam. So that industry needs to sharpen its game, and they're starting to get, you know, anti-foam. So you have to watch that. The subject matter experts that the lawyer employees, they need to be vetted, and the lawyer vets them. You know, they look at their history, where they've come from, what is their resume, how many times have they been to court, you know, all this sort of history of the value of that subject matter expert. And there's probably, you know, five or six people that I see pretty regularly. It's an industry.
Well, I think it's really interesting to me how, you know, no matter what, if someone else has a subject matter expert, I darn well better have my own on top of attorney to attorney. And so, you know, I would close with this. I am so glad you did this today, Tom. I thank you very much. But personally, I really hope, guys, that you never need him.
Right.
But if you do, make sure that you are getting yourself an attorney, that you are getting the right subject matter expert, and that you're first and foremost taking those photos, doing the daily job site reports, doing your density checks, and installing things correctly. Again, Tom, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, for the information. And I want to do the next one sometime soon, where we talk about your thoughts on metal buildings and open and closed cell spray foam.
Oh, that's an all day training right there, Ken.
Oh, no.
I look forward to that one.
No, we got to do it in 15 minutes.
Well, you know, a building science degree is 4 years, so 4 years and 10 minutes.
Four years and 10 minutes. That's perfect.
Yeah. Great stuff.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Well, guys, if you have questions on subject matter experts, spray foam, equipment, chemistry, building science, or any of the products we carry, actually, reach out to your local branch, reach out to your local sales guy, or anyone at IDI, where we look forward to earning your business every day.